Okay, this week's parasha is Parashas Korach, and we begin on page 820. Vayikach Korach, and Korach took. Korach was Ben Yitzhar, the son of Yitzhar, Ben Kohas, the son of Kohas, Ben Levi, the son of Levi, V'Dasan V'Aviram Ben Eliav, and men named Dasan and Aviram, sons of Eliav, V'Oid Ben Peles, together with a man named Ein, the son of Peles, Bnei Reuven, the sons of Reuven. Vayokumu lifnei Moshe, they arose before Moshe, Vanashm de Yisrach HaMishim HaMasayim, together with 250 men from the Jewish people, the Siye Eda, princes of the assembly, Kriye Mayit Anshe Shem, who are called for gathering men of high esteem, of great name. So this is Korach gathering and his original and his group, who now go and complain to Moshe about the fact that Moshe and Aaron have taken all the high positions, and why do they lift it? Why do they raise themselves over everyone? Everyone's holy. Everybody have a chance to participate in the highest forms of serving Hashem, meaning the service of the Kohen Gadol. Now, this very first word, or these very first words, Vayikach Korach and Korach took. If you read the verse, it says Korach and Dathan and Aviram and Oren ben Peles, or it says Korach took and Dathan and Aviram, etc. Doesn't say what they took. And Rashi tells that it means they took themselves away from everyone by creating a quarrel, separating themselves from everyone, creating disunity. The very first Rashi, the very, very first Rashi on the words Vayikach Korach says, Parshazu, this portion of the Torah, Yafa Nidreshes, is well interpreted, the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma and the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma. There are a number of forms of Medrash. There's a Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma, there's Medrash Rabbah. So Rashi tells us that this parsha is well explained in the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma, which Rashi really means to say that in order to understand the pshat, the simple explanation of these, or actually the way he's going to explain this parsha, he's going to explain it according to the interpretation, according to the midrashic interpretation of Rabbi Tanchuma, sounding like parsha zu yafa nidreshes. This parsha, this portion of the Torah, is well interpreted in the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma, and therefore that's the interpretation I'm going to use to interpret this portion of the Torah, these verses. So there's a commentary called Divrei David on Rashi that asks on the way Rashi expresses himself, Parsha zu yafa nidreshes. This parsha is well interpreted in the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma, and other portions of the Torah are not. Is that how we supposed to interpret this? This is well interpreted. In other places, it's not well interpreted. Or it means, you know, this is really good interpretation, but sometimes it's not as good. I mean, how do we understand that phrase when Rashi says, this parsha is well interpreted? It sounds like Rashi's saying, there's a really good interpretation of Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma for this portion, and that's how I'm going to explain it. But it sounds like Rashi is saying this is well interpreted, which has a connotation of, in other places, aren't well interpreted or as well interpreted. And the Divrei David asks that there is actually a Gemara in Erevin that tells us, Sha'asr Laimar, it's forbidden to say, Halacha zu Noah, that this law, that this lesson is Noah, it's pleasant, it's pleasing. The Halacha zu Eina Noah. This halacha is not pleasing, is not pleasant. You know, this halacha is Noah, is pleasing. This halacha is not pleasing. You're not supposed to say that. And Rashi here seems to be saying that when he says this portion is well, is yafa, is nicely interpreted. The Gemara seems to say, you're not supposed to say Noah. You're not supposed to say this halacha is nice. This is a pleasant. This is enjoyable. Can't find the right word to use here, but it means Noah means pleasant. Okay, so you're not allowed to say this halacha is pleasant, this halacha is not pleasant. And Rashi seems to be saying that with those words, that this parasha is well interpreted in the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma. So then the Divrei David says, well, maybe the Gemara means to say, because he's quoting the Gemara. The Gemara says you're not supposed to say that this lesson is pleasant, this lesson isn't pleasant. Divrei David says, maybe the way to interpret the Gemara is that you can't say both together. You can't say this halacha is pleasant, this halacha is not pleasant. Because then you're clearly, you know, comparing or contrasting. But if all you say is, this one is pleasant, maybe there's nothing wrong with that. Because clearly, it's not as clear, it's definitely not implying as strongly as when you say both. So the Divrei Tzemach David says, no, that's not how to read the Gemara. You don't read the Gemara that way. That means that you have to say both. Only saying one, saying it's pleasant, is not appropriate because of what it implies. When the Gemara is mentioning both, the Gemara is saying, the way to explain the Gemara is if you're not, you should not say this halacha is pleasant, because that implies that a different one isn't pleasant. So therefore, just saying one, just saying this is pleasant, this law is pleasant, is inappropriate because it's implying that another one isn't. So how do we understand Rashi's wording? Rashi says, this parasha is nicely interpreted. Sounds like in another play, other parashas are not nicely interpreted. Says the Divrei David, that what Rashi means to say is like this. Of course, you're not supposed to say, as the Gemara says, this halacha is pleasant, which would imply others aren't. But here, Rashi means to say something else. Rashi means to say that we have a problem here, especially in the first word, two words, Vayikach Korach, Torach, Korach took. What did he take? It doesn't say what he took. It never says he took anything. So we know that Rashi tries always, as Rashi tells us in the book in Sefer Bereishis, that Rashi always means to interpret Lefi Pshutai. Rashi always wants to interpret, why his interpretation was to interpret the wording of the Torah according to its pshat, according to its simple interpretation. When Rashi brings in a medrash, in medrashic interpretation, it's because there is a question on the pshuta, there's a question on the simple interpretation, there's something that the simple interpretation doesn't seem to cover. Therefore, Rashi brings in the medrash to cover any kind of questions that we may have on the basic interpretation. But Rashi always wants to start with basic interpretation. If he needs the midrashic interpretation, he brings it in. Here, Rashi has a problem. There's no pshat. There is no simple interpretation to Vayikach Korach. It doesn't work. In order even to give a basic interpretation, you need the medrash. That's what Rashi here means when he says that this parsha is Yafa Nidrash. It's nicely interpreted. It's well interpreted in Midrash Tanchuma. Rashi means to say that the pshat, the basic interpretation, is well interpreted in the Midrash. Because you can't get through the simple interpretation here without the Midrash. So Rashi doesn't mean to, so to speak, express a compliment or some kind of a description of a rating of sorts, that, you know, this parish is nice, and this is nice, which would imply something else isn't nice. That's not what Rashi's doing. Rashi's not coming to respond or to react to how nice an interpretation it is. Rashi means to say that this is well interpreted, means to say the simple interpretation, which is the way Rashi always wants to go with, that you must come on to the Medrash for that. Because without it, you're not going to have any interpretation. So Yafa Nidresh, it's nicely interpreted, means that to get even the simple pshat here in this parsha, you've got to go to the Medrash. Because it says, Vayikach, Korach, Korach took, doesn't say what he took. And it's only because of the Medrash Tanchuma that helps us understand those words, Vayikach, Korach, and Korach took. So that's the Divrei David. So Chacham Avadi Yosef, Zatzal, in his Shuva Sefer called Yabia Omer, he discusses this also, and he actually disagrees with the Divrei David that there's too many places in the Talmud that we find that the Chachamim expressed, you know, oh, this is very good, this is a beautiful lesson, this is a beautiful idea. We find throughout Shas of Chazal do that. So it can't be that there's something wrong with expressing your great liking for a lesson and say you can't express it because it implies others are different. There are too many places in Shas that we find not that way, that we find the Chachamim expressing their pleasure with a lesson, with a teaching. And therefore, Chacham Yosef says that you got to take the Gemara as it says. And that is, you want to go and express that there's a lesson that's very pleasing to you, go ahead. If that's your reaction, you can react that way. But you can't react that way when you're trying to imply that something else is different. The Gemara says, you're not supposed to say, this lesson is pleasant, this lesson isn't pleasant. You're not supposed to say that. You're not supposed to say that. You're not supposed to say both. And you're not supposed to ever have an intention to say both. If your intention is just, again, to react that this is a nice lesson, okay. So the way he says it is interesting. He says like this. Okay. If, let's say, you heard two lessons, okay? So number one, to go with the Gemara says you can't say both. You can't say this is pleasant, this is not pleasant, because you know that's saying that something of Torah isn't pleasant. That's not appropriate to say. But let's say you have a situation where you know you're learning, and someone shares with you a Torah thought. You don't react. Don't say anything. Okay. Then they teach you another thought, and that you say, "Oh, that's nice." Okay, so the first thing you reacted to, the second one you didn't react to. Okay, so there Chacham Yosef says it's going to depend on your intention. If you intend to mean when you're saying that, when you react the second time and you say, "Oh, that's nice," right? If your intention is to, if your intention when you say on the second thing that's nice is that's nice and the first thing's not, then only you know what you meant to say, but that you're not allowed to do. But even in that situation, the first one you respond to, the second one you didn't. And the second one you respond to because that one, you know, really grabbed you. Right? That one really grabbed you. If that's your intention because there's a thought that really grabs you, okay, that's no different. That's no different even when you didn't react to something else before. That's the same thing as just on one lesson saying, this is pleasant. But again, to go ahead and say outright, this is pleasant, this is not pleasant, that a person's not allowed to do. And therefore, Rashi doesn't have a problem. There's no problem with Rashi, because all Rashi said is, this parsha is yafin adreshes, this parsha is nicely interpreted. You're allowed to express, if something is very pleasing to you, you're allowed to express it. What about, does it imply other things? Not necessarily. I mean, again, and if it implies that other things didn't hit you as well as other things, okay, that's your personal preference. Right? As long as you're not saying or intending to say that something else is not pleasant, then there's nothing wrong with it. If that's your intention, that you're not allowed to say. But if your intention is just to express how something is very pleasing to you, if that's your intention, you can say that even if you're saying that following a different lesson, they didn't react to it all. Okay, so it's an interesting discussion here, how the Gemara says how careful you have to be about how you talk about Torah lessons. Right? You have to be careful. You have to be respectful to them. You have to make sure you don't in any way say or even mean to imply that something is pleasant, but a different Torah lesson isn't. Okay. The next thing is, we're very familiar with the whole story of the parsha, of how Korach tried to lead a rebellion against Moshe, and how Rashi tells us, Korach started being jealous over the fact that Moshe, all three of them, they were cousins. They were all from the same family of Kohath. Moshe was the leader. Aaron became the Kohen Gadol. Okay, even though you've got two of the highest positions to one member of the family of Kohath, which was Amram. Okay, next in line should have been him to be the prince of the family of Kohath, and he was passed over for a different cousin. Actually, for the son of the youngest of the four sons of Kohath. So, Gemara Rashi brings down that created jealousy in Korach's mind over the fact that he was passed over for that position. And once he was passed over for that position, and he resented being passed over for that position, he already decided to challenge Moshe on all the positions and to go even after the Kohuna Gadola. Okay. So when we look at Korach, we look at Korach as a, you know, he was power hungry. He was jealous. He was passed up for the position. He got no positions. And he became so upset over getting no positions that he went and challenged Moshe's appointments, all of Moshe's appointments, and to say, I want to be Kohen Gadol. I want to be Kohen Gadol. There is a Mishnah Pirkei Avos that says the following. Mishnah Pirkei Avos, this is in the fifth chapter. It's Mishnah Yudches. And the Mishnah reads, any argument that is for the sake of heaven, will eventually endure. It will endure, it will have positive results. But an argument that is not for the sake of heaven, it's not going to last. It's not going to have good results. What's an example of an argument that is for the sake of heaven? Those are the arguments that took place between the sages Hillel and Shammai, who are well known for their arguments in Torah, but they were arguing L'shem Shammai for the sake of heaven. It was all sincere. It was all for the purpose of understanding the word Hashem, nothing about anything, any personal motives. And therefore, that is an argument that endures, because both sides, Hillel and Shammai, they're both study, they're both part of Torah. Even though we actually follow Hillel's opinion most of the time, but we still mention Shammai, we still study Shammai, and we know that actually, it says that when Mashiach comes, we're going to follow Shammai's opinion. So that's an argument that lasts, that endures. The She'en L'Shem Shammayim, but an argument that's not for the sake of heaven, what's an example of that? Zum Achlekes Karech V'Adasai, that's the argument of Karech and his assembly against Moshe. That argument is an argument that was not for the sake of heaven, and therefore it did not endure. Basically, the whole thing fell apart, and they were all destroyed. And they are all now, for eternity, they're considered a negative lesson. They teach us how not to be. Okay. So Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch points out the following. If the Mishnah is contrasting a machlekes for the sake of heaven, and a machlekes that's not for the sake of heaven. The machlekes that's for the sake of heaven is Hillel and Shammai. Two sages involved in Torah study, intensive Torah study, they were involved, their arguments were all Hashem Shemayim, all for the sake of heaven. So, and we contrast that with Korach. Okay? Now, if Korach was all about a power grab, if Korach was all about seeking power and seeking honor, and that's all it was, Korach was just looking for honor, and he went all out to try to undermine Moshe and to get that power. If that's what Korach was, so then the way, if you want to now contrast Hillel, Shammai, and Korach and Moshe, Hillel and Shammai were involved in a spiritual endeavor, and Korach and his assembly were involved in what? In honor seeking, in power grabbing. That's what it's about. It's really, if you want to contrast them, I mean, it's just two complete opposites. These were two people involved in spiritual pursuits. This was a man in his assembly involved in a pursuit of vanity. I mean, there's no greater contrast than that. But the Mishnah doesn't describe the contrast like that. The Mishnah contrasts them of saying, this one's for the sake of heaven, this one's not for the sake of heaven. When you want to say someone does something not for the sake of heaven, you're saying, for instance, this person is studying Torah for the sake of heaven. This person is studying Torah for honor. Okay, are they both doing a mitzvah? Are they both doing something? Are they both involved in something spiritual? Yes, studying Torah. It's a mitzvah to study Torah, even for honor. Most of us do that. Well, most of us are studying Torah for not L'Shem Shemayim. We're not solely doing for the sake of heaven. There's some kind of, very often there's an ulterior motive deep down. Okay, but again, but at least, you know, but we're involved in a mitzvah, right? So one person's doing a mitzvah with complete L'Shem Shemayim, with total sincerity, and another person doing a mitzvah for honor, not totally sincere, but he's doing a mitzvah. If you want to say one person L'Shem Shemayim, one person's not, they're both doing the same thing, but one's motives are these, and the other one's motives is that. And that's what it sounds like in the Mishnah by Korach, comparing Hillel and Shammai and Korach. They're both doing something, they're both doing the same thing, but one is Hashem Shammai and one's not. That's not true. They're not doing the same thing. One is studying Torah, one's doing a mitzvah, and one's looking for honor, and they're not doing a mitzvah at all. You don't compare those and say one is Hashem Shammai and one's not. And therefore, Rabbi Yochanan Lubavitch explains that really this Mishnah is giving us a very big, is really opening our eyes to really what Korach was about. We should not look at Korach just as a person running for office, or just as a person who's trying to usurp power because he's power hungry. Because if that's what he is, you can't compare him to Hillel and Shammai at all. Therefore, in essence, Korach's whole argument on Moshe was actually a spiritual pursuit. He wanted to be close to Hashem. His desire of being a Kohen Gadol was not about power. It was about the unique experience and closeness to Hashem that a Kohen Gadol has. He wanted that too. That's what he was doing. His pursuit was a spiritual pursuit. That's what he was about. That's what he was doing. And we'll see, and it's clear from a lot of places like that. Says the Mishnah, though, but there's a problem. As much as Korach's pursuit was spiritual, it was about being close to Hashem, if it would have stopped there, if somehow or another Korach would have had a mistaken pursuit of closest to Hashem, but that mistaken pursuit would have been completely l'shem Shemayim for the sake of heaven, Korach would not have become a tragedy. Wouldn't have been a tragedy. The outcome would have been different. Would have been a different outcome. Doesn't mean he would have gotten his way. Would have been a different outcome. It would be sort of like it would have been like Hillel and Shammai, where we follow one, we don't follow the other, but we study the other. We remember the other. Because the other was also studying Torah. The other was also l'shem Shemayim for the sake of heaven. But the Mishnah is telling us that even though Korach was pursuing spirituality, Korach was pursuing closest to Hashem, there was shaloi l'shem Shemayim mixed in. There was ulterior motive mixed in.
So he felt he was a better person than Aaron.
Whatever it was that he felt, at the end of the day, the problem was is that as much as he was pursuing closeness to Hashem, it was a spiritual pursuit similar to Hillel and Shammai studying Torah. They are both spiritual pursuits. Korach, the problem with Korach was is that there was shaloi l'shem Shemayim. There was a certain degree of not doing it for the sake of heaven. There was a certain amount of ulterior motive involved. A certain degree. Not to, again, it doesn't mean that now he was just, that because of ulterior motive, his whole focus now was power. No, his focus was not power. His focus was closest to Hashem. However, there was a degree of ulterior motive mixed in. That ulterior motive was the jealousy. That certain amount of jealousy that he felt that he didn't get the position of being the head of the family of Kahas, that certain amount of jealousy, that was what really, you know, lasted and was mixed into this pursuit of closeness to Hashem, which eventually caused it to fall apart. Because we know at the end, Korach used some pretty inappropriate means of getting his point across. But in essence, the entire time, Korach and all the people involved were striving for closeness to Hashem. That's what they were striving for. However, deep down, there was a degree of ulterior motive, and that is what basically undid everything that they were trying to do. And Rabbi Yochanan Lovitz explains, he suggests, that when it says that Korach was jealous, because he was passed up for the position that Litzafan ben Aziel got to be the prince of the family of Kahas. He says that the way we should interpret that is there is a concept, there are two types of jealousies. There's bad jealousy, and there's a jealousy called Kinas Sofrim. The jealousy that exists among scholars. That's a jealousy that doesn't, where the scholar doesn't hate his colleague, he doesn't dislike his colleague. He doesn't have a problem with his colleague succeeding, but he feels bad that he's not succeeding as well, that he's not getting where his colleague has gotten. And that feeling of jealousy that he's not where his friend is motivates him to try more, motivates him to strive harder. But it's not a jealousy in which you don't want the other person to have. It's where you look at yourself and you say, I should be that too. I should have that also. When Korach first was jealous of Elitzafan ben Uziel, that Elitzafan ben Uziel got the position he didn't, in his mind, he may have started feeling what we call a kinas seifrim. You know, to have the merit to be a leader of the Jewish people, I wish I had that too. I wish I had that also. What's missing in me that I didn't get that? But we can very well understand that there is a very thin line between, well, it's called kosher jealousy and not kosher jealousy. One can understand that it doesn't take much to step over the line. And that's what eventually Korach did.
He's assuming he's a better person.
He's assuming that, not necessarily,
he's better for the job.
He's assuming that he has a right for the job as much as anybody else,
right.
And that Aaron should not have gotten it if Moshe got the leadership position, and therefore, he should have the second next position. Because he definitely was a great man. There's not a question.
But he took the position that he's at least the same level as Aaron.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Basically, he's saying to himself,
He's saying to himself that I will be the kohen gadol. That I will be the kohen gadol. Whatever it may be, he's thinking. But the point is that whatever he is thinking, the point of Rabbi Yochanan is to say that whatever he's thinking is thinking for the point to be closer to Hashem. However, and that's pretty clear from the Mishnah. The Mishnah Kavis does not make sense. But you know, like I say, there are many times that we're involved in spiritual endeavors, but we have ulterior motives there too. But it's not a contradiction to have both. The problem is, the problem that the Mishnah is saying is that when you're dealing with machlekes, we're dealing with a quarrel, we're dealing with fighting, if there's not l'shem shemayim, if there's ulterior motive in that, that's trouble. That's big trouble. Because that is going to cause it eventually to fall apart and to turn to something very ugly and very bad. So again, you could have a spiritual pursuit and have ulterior motives at the same time. But when it happens in a machlekes, in a quarrel, that's big, big trouble. And one of the signs that really shows us that there was a degree of ulterior motive in what Korach was doing, which caused his downfall, is because of the fact that we know eventually he turned to Letzanis, he turned to mocking Moshe. He turned to mocking many of the mitzvahs of the Torah, trying to show that Moshe had made this up by himself. You know, if you turn to mockery, if you turn to mocking your opponent, then that already shows that it's personal. And Korach, in Korach's mind, this is what he needed to do. You know, this is what he needed to do. He felt that he wanted his closest to Hashem. Moshe was depriving him of that closest to Hashem, and therefore he needed to do what he needed to do. Moshe's a powerful man. He's got to employ what he needs to do. But once you start employing Litzanus mockery, which means this is what you feel you need, this is what you tell yourself, this is what I need to succeed, if that's where you're going, that means already it's personal. A person who's not personal is going to stand up for what he has to do, do what's right, and do it in the right way. And not lower himself and not lower himself in order to get his way. And this is what Korach did. And that shows where that the whole thing with that there was Shalei L'shem Shemayim, that shows there was a certain degree of insincerity in what he was doing. And actually, when we see that, we should actually take it for ourselves as a measuring stick. If we want to know if we get involved in a certain kind of quarrel, right? And unfortunately, these kind of quarrels in life can manifest themselves in a lot of different ways. And some of them can get very, very ugly and very dirty. And really messy. These things can happen. The way to measure to see, are you trying to be sincere, is the manner in which you behave. And the manner in which you try to put out your position. When you get to a point, if one of the things that you're doing is that you're really mocking the other side, then you have to start thinking to yourself, hey, am I being sincere or am I not being sincere?
But that's been a problem with people, you know, for thousands of years.
Sure, definitely.
Nothing's changed.
Right. Now, the Chafetz Chaim in this week's Parsha brings an interesting... Well, actually, let me go... that's part of something else. I'm sorry. One second. Okay. Now, next thing I want to discuss is the fact that in the first pasuk, it mentions Korach, Dasan, Aviram, and a man named On ben Peles. Those three men were all from the tribe of Reuven. When you read the rest of the parasha, there's Korach, there's Dasan and Aviram, and On ben Peles is out of the picture. He is gone. No mention of him whatsoever. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, famous Gemara, tells us that On ben Peles was saved by his wife. His wife had seichel. She had a lot of common sense. So the Gemara says... So Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kuftes Amid Beis. The Gemara says, Omar Rav, Ein Ben Peles, Ishta Hitzilasei. The sage Rav said, On Ben Peles was saved by his wife. Umrele, she said to him, you know, they were sitting by the supper table, and she said to him, Ma'i nafkalachmina, what difference does this all have for you? Imar Rabba and Talmida. Imar Rabba and Talmida. Whichever one is going to be on top is going to be the student. Which means to say that she understood that as much as Korach is saying, everybody's holy, everybody should have a chance, she understood, do me a favor. There's one Kohen Gadol. And whoever's a Kohen Gadol, you're not going to be. Omar La, so what do Ein ben Peles say to her? My Evid, what am I supposed to do? Havoi Be'etza, I've been part of this council, Vishtabar Libadayo, and I swore to be part of them. I swore to be together with them. What am I supposed to do now? Amrale Yadina de Kula Kanishta Kadishtaninu. Now this is very important. She said, I know that this entire congregation, this entire assembly, are all holy people. When Kairach said everybody's holy, and the Torah says that, it's true. Everybody is holy. And therefore, Umrale Tuv, you stay here, and I will take care of everything. But again, she's saying, my plan is based on the fact that everybody is Kadosh. Ashkisei chamra barvisei v'anginisei gavoi. She gave him wine to drink, she got him a little tipsy, she made him fall asleep, and she put him to bed. Oisva albava, she sat by the door. V'sasarta lamaze. And what did she do? She took off her head covering. She let down her hair. Called Asa, so then when the people of Kairach came to get Oin, Hadar. Called Asa, Chazya Hadar. Whoever came and saw her backed off. These are holy people. These are holy people. These aren't thugs. Again, it shows you. These are even Kairach and his people were not thugs. We're not people that, you know, hey, you know, I don't care how she's dressed. We got to get him out. No. But if he's shikar and sleep and sleeping, so he can't get up if they call him. If they try to get in there and wake him up, she's sitting there without her hair covered. See, they wouldn't dare come in then. So first of all, again, you show that we're not dealing with a bunch of thugs here that are just, you know.
Didn't know he's sleeping?
They probably called for him, and he didn't respond.
But did she say something to them?
It doesn't say that. But it's just the way the Mefarshim say is, by knocking him out, then when they call, he doesn't respond. Okay? If they try coming in to see what's going on, they right away saw she's by the door with her hair uncovered, they're not coming in. Okay? This is how Owen's wife protected him and saved him. Okay. So, the Berachos Peretz makes a very interesting point here. The argument that Owen's wife said to him was not rocket science. Was not. It was very practical. It was very realistic. She says, who are you fooling? You're never going to be the Kohen Gadol. Okay? So, do you think anybody thought of that too? Was she the only one who thought of this? Was she the only one that was smart enough to think about this, to realize this?
No.
Do you think other people thought about it also? They probably did.
But they
didn't care. They didn't care. They wanted a covet that they weren't going to get anyway. They weren't going to get it. Which says the Berachos Peretz that what you see from here is that once you get into a quarrel and you get dragged in, you don't think anymore. You know, you join a side and you just follow it. And you just follow it. You don't think straight.
For the sake of Shemayim, in their view?
In their view, they are. In their view, they are, and to a degree, they definitely were striving to be close to Hashem. But, again, because there was, again, Kairach was not L'shem Shemayim, and Kairach was a very charismatic fellow, and he gained a big following. And don't forget, other people had their own little things. You know, all the Jews had a stake here, because as the Ramban says later on, that when all the Jews came to see what's going to happen, they were going to wait and see that, well, maybe Korach's going to win, and all our Bukharim, our firstborn, will come back and be the Kohanim. I mean, in their minds, there was a lot at stake here that was actually relevant, that was actually personal to them. So there was a lot of personal motive involved in here. And therefore, you know, again, you get into a quarrel. It's a quarrel that again, if you personally would really be L'shem Shemayim, hopefully you'd have enough seichel to realize what's going on. You'd have a clearer thought to realize what's going on. But when you get into a machlekes, and you get into the heat of the machlekes, you get into the heat of the fight, and you're all highly emotional, which that in itself already, it means you're not L'shem Shemayim, you're not doing for the sake of heaven, you come to a point that you just follow. You follow and you don't think. So the Chafetz Chaim brings a very interesting story. The Chafetz Chaim Alatar brings on a story that he says there was one time a small town, and the small town had this person in charge of the town, let's call him the mayor of the town, and he had a neighbor. And the neighbor and the mayor got into a big fight. So the neighbor threatened the mayor that he's going to go to the government and he's going to tell them all the shtick that he pulls, all the different illegal things that he does. that he's a state, he's a state official, and he doesn't follow the law. He threatened him he's going to go and tell on him. So his wife says to him, "What are you doing? Don't you realize that as the mayor, city, the mayor of the city with its connections, he got our son off from the draft? Because of him, our son wasn't drafted. If he now is taken away from his position, then anything that he did is going to fall apart. So what are you doing?" So the man said, "My dear, it's worth it that you should go to jail, and that I should go to jail, and all our children should go to jail to bring this guy down." That is an example of how you lose your rational thinking when you get into a fight. Now, when it's really personally involving you, that's clear. But the point is that machlekes, getting into a quarrel, is very dangerous because you very easily cross the line into anger, you lose control of your emotion, you lose control of your rational thinking. Now, just to share with you a very interesting short story of how great people avoided machlekes, how great people avoided any kind of dispute. Rabbi Yosef Yisrael Horowitz was known as the Alter von Nevardik, the Elder of Nevardik. Nevardik was a city in Europe, Lithuania, had a yeshiva, and actually Nevardik was the headquarters of a whole system of yeshivas. And the leader of that yeshiva was Rabbi Yosef Yisrael Horowitz. So Rabbi Horowitz was notified how a very wealthy donor in Germany had left behind his house or some kind of structure for the Nevardik yeshiva. He was a donor, and he left behind in his will that this and this building, I don't know if it was his house or some other building, should go to the Nevardik yeshiva. That building goes to the Nevardik yeshiva. Yeshiva and Nevardik can sell the building and make a nice amount of money to support the yeshiva. He immediately set out for Germany to rearrange things. As he was traveling, he was told, or he found out, that another yeshiva was on its way to Germany. And they were also going to go lay claim on that building. And he checked into it, and he realized that this can turn into a very, very bitter fight. And he turned around and he went home. And he let the other yeshiva go and get it. All to avoid machlekes.
Shouldn't they have maybe made a compromise?
He realized that that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. He realized it's going to turn into a fight, and he said, "Not worth it." As much as it was a loss to the yeshiva, and believe me, yeshivas in Europe were, in Lithuania were always in great need for funds, but at the cost of machlekes, of a quarrel, he wasn't going to do it.
Does it say his wife who saved him, what family she was from or anything? No.
Nope. Doesn't tell us her yichus. Probably she was from the tribe of Reuven. Most of the time I think they married within the tribe anyway.
She must have gone to Beis Yaakov.
I don't think so, but she definitely had a good upbringing.
Similar.
Okay.
But Rabbi, in that example, when you back away from something, would the perception becomes that you're weakling?
Every case has to be taken on its own merit, but it's very possible that, yeah, look like a weakling, but better not get into a fight. Because fights are just, they're fire. Now again, it takes big people to do that. But it's all part of a lesson of how careful we have to be with machlekes, because it's very rarely that anything good comes from it. Okay. Let's now turn to page 824. And this is Perek Tes Zayin Pasuk Chaf. So at this point, Moshe had told Korach and his whole assembly, all right, everybody's going to bring Ketores at the Mishkan, and God is going to show us who is meant to be the Kohen Gadol and who's not. So at that point, everybody came to watch. The Pasuk actually before says, Pasuk Yutes, verse 19 says, Vayakel aleihem Korach es kol ha'eda. Korach assembled everyone, a Pesach Olam Mo'ed, to the entrance of the Olam Mo'ed, Vayerak Vayda Hashem al Kol Aida, and the honor of Hashem appeared to the entire assembly. Korach called everybody to come watch, and everybody came, and Hashem's glory appeared in the Mishkan, and that was not good. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe v'al Aaron leimar, and Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron, saying, Ki badl mitoch Aida hazais. Separate yourselves from this assembly. V'achalo isam karaga, and I will wipe them away in a split second. They were all chayiv misa. They were all deserving of being wiped out for coming to watch. Moshe and Aaron fell on their faces and they said, God, the God of spirits of all flesh. One man is going to sin. And get mad and angry at everyone. What are they saying to Hashem? This is all Korach's fault. He started this whole thing. So because of him, everybody has to suffer? So the Ramban says, wait a minute. Let's try to understand something here. If Korach was the only one that was really guilty, why would the Rabbanu Shalom say, to begin with, I'll kill them all, I should wipe them all out? And if they did do something wrong, then what is the point of what Moshe and Aaron is saying, only Korach sinned? What do you mean only Korach sinned? Everybody sinned. That's why Hashem wants to punish them. So therefore the Ramban says like this. The Ramban says that originally, you know, there's a couple of stages here. The beginning of the parsha is where Korach and his assembly approach Moshe and Aaron. Okay? At that point, the Jewish people as a whole are behind Moshe and Aaron. But now, when it's a showdown, when now you have Korach and everybody at the Mishkan, and they're about to now go through the test to see who's right and who's wrong, and Korach gets everybody to come, and they come. They come, they're interested, you know? And they say, you know, maybe Korach's right. And if he's right, all our firstborns will be back to being Kohanim. All of a sudden now, they actually started, you know, having a different attitude. Who caused that? Who brought them together? Korach brought them together. He was the cause of it. But at the end of the day, they came. Therefore, Hashem says, they came. They're challenging Moshe's prophecy. They're challenging the prophet, the Hashem's prophet, upon who the whole Torah rests. They deserve to be destroyed. Moshe and Aaron employ, what Ramban says, a kind of prayer that we find many of the leader Jewish people did. And that is, they try to mitigate what the klal did. They try to mitigate what the Jewish people did. And it is. And how do they mitigate? In a real way. Look, he got them to do it. If not for him, they wouldn't have done it. So basically, he's a troublemaker. He for sure deserves to be punished. Punish him, spare them. That's what they try to do. And the wording is, he says, V'zaderech mevak shei rachamim. And this is the manner of those who beseech mercy on the Jewish people. Sheyakalu achet me'al ha'am. They'll try to lighten, mitigate the sin from upon the nation. V'noisenoisei al yochel goyrim. And they put the whole blame on the individual who caused it all. V'meishuchai v'kol panim. Because at the end of the day, he's liable for sure. He sinned. He's the troublemaker. He for sure deserves to be punished. So punish him because he was the cause of it all. Then the Ramban goes into another example. Another example, an interesting example from a story in Tanakh, which actually carries a very, very interesting lesson. There is a episode at the end of Shmuel Beis, where David HaMelech is king. The Jewish people actually have been through a three-year drought, three-year famine. And David HaMelech decides to count the Jewish people, to take a census of the Jewish people. Okay? So let me ask you a question. How do you remember, when you take a census of the Jewish people, how are you supposed to do that?
Well, the men 20 years up.
That's age. How are you supposed to do the census? How do you do it?
For the men, no?
How do you do it? How do you perform the census?
You put the money in?
Everybody has to give a half a shekel, and you count the half shekel. David HaMelech didn't do it. He counted everyone without doing it. He counted it without everyone giving that half shekel, which the Torah describes in Parshas Kisisa as an atonement, as a protection. He didn't do it. And guess what happened? A plague came. And the Jewish people were dying. And David HaMelech turns to Hashem and he says, Hine anoichi chatasi, I'm the one who sinned. V'anoichi havesi, I'm the one who's guilty. Ve'la atzon ma asu. What did they do? I caused it. I'm the one who brought it on them. You want to punish someone? Punish me. Punish my family. But spare them. That's what David HaMelech said. Now there too, if the Jewish people were suffering, says the Ramban, there has to be some guilt on their part. David HaMelech is trying to mitigate the guilt, but there has to be some guilt on their part. What did they do wrong? So the first explanation the Ramban gives is, what they did wrong was, is that David HaMelech went around making a census. The same way David HaMelech was supposed to know you have to do it by taking money from people, the people themselves should have known that. The people themselves should have known that whoever was taking the census, that they have to take it a half a shekel and give it. They should know it themselves. And therefore, when they allowed themselves to be counted without giving the half shekel, they themselves were guilty of being counted without the protection of the money. And therefore, it was appropriate. It was appropriate that they were punished. David HaMelech, as Ramban says, is following the path of those who seek mercy for the Jewish people, and they try to mitigate what they did and put the blame on the person who was the instigator who caused the whole thing. That's one explanation of the Ramban. The other explanation of the Ramban is that, again, David HaMelech is trying to mitigate things because it was his count without taking the money that now brought this new punishment. But the Ramban says, what did they do wrong? What they did wrong is that for years, until Shlomo HaMelech came around, or until David HaMelech wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, the Aron was always in temporary places, from one place to another place, from one place to another place. The Jewish people on their own never sought to give the Aron a permanent place. They didn't. The only one who did eventually ask is David HaMelech. He wanted to do it. And Hashem said, no, you're a man of war. You can't do it. Your son will do it. But the Jewish people, says the Ramban, if they would have wanted a Beis HaMikdash, if they would have wanted to give the Aron its proper respect, and they would have demanded it, they would have asked for it. So says the Ramban, it could have happened during the days of the Shoftim, that one of the Shoftim would have done it. It could have happened by Shaul HaMelech. And he says, you know what, it could even happen by David. Because even though David was doing the wars, if the Jewish people are asking for it, so David HaMelech is just their emissary. And then you don't have to worry about the fact that he's a man of war. The fact that he's a man of war is only a problem when he's the only one trying to get the Beis HaMikdash built. He's the only one who's trying to establish it. Okay, he can't establish it because he's a man of war. But if the Jewish people are the one trying to establish it, he's just their emissary, it wouldn't be a problem. That is what Ramban says was their sin. The sin of the Jewish people up to this point of time that now allowed them to be punished when the counting was done incorrectly, and it was against brought upon them by David HaMelech. But why were they worthy of punishment, says the Ramban? Because of all the years that they should have asked. They should have wanted to give the Aron the Beis HaMikdash a permanent place to be in, and they didn't do so. And because of the fact they didn't do so, and they didn't show that respect or that desire to have a Beis HaMikdash, that's why they were liable for punishment. And the Ramban is really telling us that the Jewish people have to want to have a Beis HaMikdash. They have to want to have a permanent place for the Aron. They have to want to have a place where the Shechina can rest. They want to have a place where they could have the closest to Hashem and the highest level. When they don't ask for that, that's their sin. That's their sin. And that is a lesson for us. How much the same way they were held responsible for the fact that they were not seeking a Beis HaMikdash in their times. That's what brought the punishment upon them. That is something for us as we approach the month of Tammuz and we're getting close to Shabbos and Tammuz and Tisha B'Av and commemorating the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, to remember this lesson of how the Jewish people were punished when they didn't seek a Beis HaMikdash, and how important it is for us to yearn and seek the Beis HaMikdash to return.